I can't help it. I don't care how far you think the analogy extends itself. When I see you making that bus driver climb up and down, on and off the roof of his bus for your amusement for hours in the hot sun, I think of how we once had to dance and sing for them while they shot our parents. When I see you keep that woman and her husband at the checkpoint while she's in labor and you stand there, listening to her scream, watching as she gives birth on the backseat of a taxi, I think of the walls around our own ghetto and how we had to crawl through the sewers looking for rats to eat while we could hear their children playing on the other side. When I see you crush that house and kill that woman and her baby with your armored bulldozer because they didn't have a permit, I think of the way we were once forced to leave our homes at the point of a gun. And when I hear your general say that in order to deal with the Intifada, you must learn from the tactics of another general, one Mr. Stroop, in Warsaw, I think of how they bombed our buildings, shot us as we fell from the roofs. And I remember how we wished we could kill their babies, too. And I feel sick, sick of your displaced anger, sick of your self-deception, sick of your attempts to deceive the rest of the world, sick of your accusations of anti-Semitism, sick of your occupation, sick of your apartheid state, sick of Zionism. Because standing here in Auschwitz, Birkenau, and Warsaw, I see Jenine, Yaffa, and Rafah. And I think of our ancestors, the Jewish Palestinians, who spoke so eloquently in their Arabic language. But the dead cannot speak. And now I find myself again behind the wall of a ghetto, standing with millions of other Palestinians. And I find myself shouting, Thawra, Thawra, Hatta al-Nasr, tomorrow in Jerusalem, al-Auda, return.
So these were the words of David Roix, reading a poem that he wrote. Welcome, David Roix, to this radio show.
Thank you.
And, well, just briefly introducing you is, I think the first time I heard about you was when the counter summit protest was starting and Seattle was happening, and I heard the song "We'll Shut Them Down."
Mm.
And since then, I think in my political experience, at least you've been following different struggles, political struggles that I've been involved with, and we have shared common friends or people mm-hmm. that we know each other, and somehow I have always felt your music has been like a soundtrack to a lot of things that have been happening in the world and struggles we have been dealing with in the left or so on a global scale. And now you've been invited to Freiburg to play yesterday at a gig in a project called Susi from the so-called Mietshäuser-Syndikat. And unfortunately, you were presented with a situation that they did not want you to perform there. They did not want to offer you the stage as a platform for some of your opinions. This was definitely not a consensus between the people from Susi, but at least the organizer crew took that decision in the end after some discussion, and you performed in another project nearby from the Mietshäuser-Syndikat. One of the things they are criticizing about your music, which is dealing with a lot of issues, but also dealing with the issues of Israel and Palestine, is reflected in the first poem that we just heard, mm-hmm. which is called Return, and is the fact that you many times do analogies between the Nazi regime and the Israeli state. And mm-hmm. I think many of your positions are very critical towards the Israeli state. And in Germany, at least, there is a culture, or at least some the positions that are, you know, very diverse within the German left. But in general, it's if you criticize the Israeli state and if you draw analogies between Nazi regime and Israel, you're risking to some relativism about the Holocaust or belittlement. Many people consider the Holocaust as something that has been very singular, that will hopefully not repeat or hasn't been repeated like that in the world.
Mm.
And so it's you're moving on a dangerous ground whenever you start comparing Nazi regime and Israel. And yeah, the song that we just heard, this is something that you do. But maybe as a first question, who is we in the poem?
The Jews.
The Jews. How did you relate to that, and how did you draw the connection between the two situations? On the one hand, for instance, in the Warsaw ghetto, and on the other hand, which you compare to the Gaza Strip, for instance.
It's a comparison that people all over the world who are familiar with both of the histories of the Israeli occupation of Palestine and the German Nazi movement, it's a comparison that people make automatically because it's so obvious. Because you see the victims of the Holocaust settling and invading another country and displacing hundreds of thousands of people, putting them into walled ghettos, starving them and bombing them. So the comparison is obvious to anybody that has their eyes open. But it's a comparison that is obviously a minefield anywhere in the world. And the people who usually make the comparison are people who are not very political, like just regular people on the streets. If they read about it, they see a documentary, whatever, they'll think, oh, wow, those people who were victims of the Holocaust, they went and colonized another country, and now they're doing, quote, the same thing, unquote. This is what people will say. I have never said that. So anybody that's saying that I'm making a direct comparison and saying that they're, quote, the same thing, unquote, is not accurately representing my position, because I actually am quite knowledgeable about the history of Nazi Germany and the history of Israel and Palestine. And so I'm very aware that it's not the same thing. And the difference is that Israel doesn't have gas chambers. That's the difference. So, and that's a big difference. One of the most popular slogans of Israeli Jewish settlers in the West Bank is "Gas the Arabs." And you'll see this slogan on structures, rocks, and buildings all over the West Bank. They love this one. They know how shocking it is, and that's why they love it.
But still, let's say the dimension of the Holocaust is quite unique in history, and also what people in the German left always say, it's the very systematic way of organizing, almost industrial way of organizing human crime was really difficult to imagine sometimes. And but you draw the comparison. You say in your poem, standing here in Auschwitz, it feels to me like standing here in Auschwitz, Birkenau, and Warsaw, I see Jenin, Jaffa, and Rafa.
Right.
So,
which is a poem. It's not something to be understood as a political analysis. It's a poem, but it's making the comparison, not saying that they're exactly the same thing, because certainly the industrial scale of the genocide that the Nazis perpetrated has no comparison in history. Certainly the Armenian genocide perpetrated by the Turkish government during the dying days of the Ottoman Empire is the closest parallel, although I think that actually the industrial scale destruction of Vietnam, Laos, and Korea by the United States Air Force, as well as the industrial scale destruction of the cities and the civilian populations of Germany and Japan by the United States Air Force, is a very comparable thing. It's much more random than gas chambers in the sort of industrial when you're talking about industrial scale slaughter, but it is very industrial scale when you drop bombs from the sky and destroy entire cities, and the most accurate genocidal sort of comparison, I would say, is Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
It's difficult to get into a logic of having to compare the awful crimes through humanity, but can you somehow relate to that to that political position of quite many people in the left in Germany that say that see that risk of relativism and belittlement of the Holocaust.
They're Germans. I'm not. Mm-hmm. I'm Jewish. And for people, I mean, I'm Jewish. I'm Jewish the way, you know, Germans are German. I mean, in the sense that I'm not some kind of ideologue. I'm not religious, you know. But I was born as Jewish as they get. In the sense that if I were alive in 1943, I'd be in a gas chamber. So you know, and I'm eligible for Israeli citizenship because I'm Jewish. So for us Jews, you know, when we see the crimes of the Israeli state, you know, unless we are part of those crimes, you know, or unless we are living with blinders on, you know, we see we are appalled. We see look at what these people are doing. How could they not have learned from the Holocaust? We see that there are different kinds of Jews in the world today. There are different kinds of people who see the world in different ways. There are those that think that that the crimes of the Nazis should never be repeated to us, and who cares about anyone else? And those are the people who run Israel. And then there are those of us who are opposed to Zionism, and opposed to occupation, and opposed to the slaughter of the Palestinian people. And we say that what we should have learned from the Nazi regime is never again to anyone. And that very much includes Palestinians. And those of us who are knowledgeable about history...
It's very similar to the sentence that Germans say, actually, nie wieder Krieg... It's something that you will find very often in the left here. Never again war,
yeah,
as it was experienced here.
Right, right, absolutely. Yeah, that's the... And so, you know, these comparisons, I mean, when you drive people off of their land, force them into open-air prisons, surround these open-air prisons, whatever you want to call them, if you want to call them ghettos or concentration camps, I don't think it matters. Germans did not invent concentration camps. I come from the United States. We invented concentration camps. They're called Indian reservations. We put the Indians on reservations. We starved them to death. That's a concentration camp. Call it what you will. We had the Indians at the time in the 19th century, if they left their concentration camps, they would be shot on sight. There was a law that Indians could be shot on sight if they left their concentration camps. So the South Africans also had concentration camps. Hitler didn't invent this stuff; he just perfected it. But you know, when you see that people have been driven into open air prisons and had a wall built around these prisons and had planes bombing these prisons, who had been prevented from importing medical supplies or food. You know, I challenge anyone out there to come up with any other examples in the past 100 years of anybody doing that. You know, the Nazis did that, and the Israelis are doing that now. Though I don't know anybody else who's done it quite that way. There have been horrible, horrible things done to people, and some of the most horrible things ever done to anybody in the history of the world have been done by my government, by the United States. And anything Israel does pales in comparison, because Israel is a very small country. And the Palestinians are relatively a small population. They've never been a very large population. So, you know, I'd say that, easily the biggest war criminal-run country in the world since 1945 is the United States. But, but Israel is a little sub-empire, and it's of great interest to me particularly, and to many other people in particular, because it's a client state of the United States. Its military budget is largely provided by the United States, and it's populated by people from New York. Mm-hmm. And all you have to do is go there and you realize this. You know, everybody's speaking fluent English, and half of them seem to have New York accents. It's not like they're making this up. They didn't get it from watching Seinfeld. You know, they're from New York.
You often refer to the Israeli state as an apartheid state, which I think some people can somehow relate to it, comparing it to South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
What concrete experiences have led you to consider Israel as an apartheid state?
I mean, I think that the comparison to South Africa is the most accurate comparison in terms of like other recent history and countries that have implemented the same kind of system. It's just that people, you know, people who specifically people of Jewish lineage are inevitably going to make other comparisons just because of our history, because of the history of the Holocaust. So it's inevitable. Also because the people in Israel were so inspired by their experiences. They learned from their oppressors. So that's why they build walls around ghettos, which I don't know if they even were doing that in South Africa. I think they were talking about building walls around the ghettos, but they hadn't gotten around to it yet. What people will say, Archbishop Desmond Tutu said when he visited Palestine, he said, this is just like South African apartheid, only worse. And that's what they will generally say if victims of South African apartheid visit Palestine. They'll say, this is very familiar, except it's even worse than what we experienced. Mm-hmm. And certainly if you go to Palestine, you know, which I think many people who are critical of people who criticize Israel, they haven't been there. And also, you know, they're really coming out of a very understandable place of German guilt. And, you know, Germany is the most guilty country on earth. It's also the most self-reflective country on earth. And very understandably, people would rather avoid the whole issue and just not talk about it. And I understand that. That's why usually I never sing about Palestine when I come here. There's a lot of other things to sing about that are a bit less sensitive for people. But certainly if you go there, you see that this is a population that is living under a oppressive military regime. There's no democracy. It's not a democratic country. That all the stuff about Israel being the only democracy in the Middle East is just completely lying. It's not a democracy. The Palestinians can't vote. The Palestinians can't even sue in civilian courts. Only they only get so-called military justice. They're subject to the military courts. They're occupied by the military. It's an occupation of one people by another people. So it's a completely one-sided situation. There's nothing equal about it. One side has tanks, the other side has rocks. That's the situation.
Ask me how it is that I dare to take a side. You say I loathe myself, pointing out you have lied. You say it's tribal warfare, but I disagree, for the dynamics of the situation are not difficult to see. On the one side is the fighter jet, on the other is the stone. On the one side is the slave, on the other is the throne. For the many there are checkpoints, while foreign soldiers rule the streets. For the one side there is victory, but the people don't accept defeat. The word you need to know is occupation, the very definition of a land without a nation. And if peace is what you're after, then let us not deceive. It'll come on the day the tanks return to Tel Aviv. On the one side there is hunger and bulldozed olive trees. On the other is the army, ruling by decrees. Caterpillars maul the streets, destroy whole city blocks, while children swallow shrapnel for the crime of throwing rocks. Fences are erected around the towns they flatten, and Herzl's own fanatics sleep on sheets of satin. And they water their plantations, drilling ever deeper wells, while the displaced children of the hopeless are filled with bullet shells. The word you need to know is occupation, the very definition of a land without a nation. And if peace is what you're after, then let us not deceive. It'll come on the day the settlers return to Tel Aviv.
being tortured once again. On the other there is rage, helplessness and fear, and a growing realization that another Holocaust is near. On the outside there are prisons, the inside detainees being stripped of their humanity, beaten naked to their knees. Outside the ghetto walls, stormtroopers all around, while inside the hungry people yearn for liberated ground. The words you need to know is occupation, the very definition of a land without a nation. And if peace is what you're after, then let us not deceive. It'll come on the day the jail guards return to Tel Aviv. All across the world you can hear the people say, children of Jerusalem will be free one day. In overcrowded camps amidst the stench of death and flies to the suburbs of Detroit, you can hear the anguish cries. While in the land of Israel, with God ever on their side, walls and fences are constructed, papers are denied. People fight for their existence while we turn a blinded eye, and those who should know better insist on asking why. The words you need to know is occupation, very definition of a land without a nation. And if peace is what you're after, then let us not deceive. It will come on the day the refugees return to Tel Aviv.
That's one of the issues, basically, that you've been criticized by the people here in Zuzi, is taking quite one-sided stake. I mean, you have highlighted that the situation is not very symmetric for you. It's, you know, tanks versus stones or so. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, would you agree that, I mean, there is also anti-Semitism is still around, and especially one of the criticisms you hear in Germany is that if you criticize the state of Israel, you will open a space, or you will find suddenly yourself in the same position as anti-Semites, or for instance Nazi would criticize the Israeli state. So
yeah, it's a minefield.
It's a minefield.
I mean, it's a minefield, but it's not going to stop being a minefield. Mm-hmm. You know, inevitably, you know, the people who are not very intelligent are going to figure that all Jews are represented by the Israeli government, and the people who really promote that idea is the Israeli government. The Israeli government is the biggest enemy of Jews in the world. The Israeli government is the biggest perpetrator of anti-Semitism in the world. If it weren't for the Israeli government, there'd be a lot less anti-Semitism in the world today, because it's the Israeli government that says, we're a democracy, we're not racist, we're not against Palestinians, and we represent all the Jews in the world. You know, and meanwhile, Jews all over the world are saying, hey, you know, you don't represent us. You know, and in fact, all the Israeli government does for Jews around the world is make their life a lot more difficult, because then you have to deal with this idea that so many people have, that that we think that Israel represents us. You know, so then, which, you know, so of course there are going to be people who will make this kind of connection. Of course, there are also people who, when they meet an American, they figure, oh, you support the occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan. So, of course, Americans have to deal with this kind of thing, just as, you know, Germans have to deal with this kind of thing. They figure, oh, you're German, you must support, you know, the starvation of the Greek people or whatever. You know, it's inevitable that there's going to be people who are not very intelligent who think that you are the same thing as your government. But, of course, you know, people and their governments are different, and especially when you live in a society that's, you know, really not very democratic.
But maybe let's get back also to the situation of resistance, because as you were doing analogies as well, you were saying that somehow, for instance, Gaza was comparable or in a similar situation as the Warsaw Ghetto, and also there was resistance in the Warsaw Ghetto, which you compare or you put that in the same level as the resistance going on in Palestine.
But I don't. I don't say it's the same level. I think the difference between having gas chambers and not having gas chambers is extremely significant. Mm-hmm. You know, the difference between taking, you know, whatever it was, one third or one half of a population, such as the Jewish population in Europe, and killing them in gas chambers, mm-hmm. is a completely different situation than anything that anyone has ever done in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. So and I make that point in the essay that has been quoted by the Zuzi people, the Israeli terror. They choose to ignore the fact that I make that point because they're intellectually lazy, I would say, or they're trying to make a point without actually reading what I say, because that point, which is a very important point, is how you can see the rest of the essay. That is important. It's the context that the rest of the essay is in. So if you ignore the context, if you ignore the fact that I make a very clear distinction between gassing millions of people and not gassing millions of people, well, then, you know, you can say whatever you want, but the similarities are when you drive people off their land, surround them with walls, bomb them, and starve them. These are the similarities, and I think anybody who's paying attention can see that there are these similarities. It's not like every government in the world goes around driving people off their land, surrounding them with walls, and bombing them. This is not just like a normal thing.
Okay, but with your music and songs, you have been supporting the resistance within Palestine, and you have been linked to organizations like Hamas or the PFLP at solidarity events or so. When do you consider resistance to be something legitimate, and when do you consider the resistance going to the point of, killing civilians and run also by anti-Semitism or hate? Where do you draw a line?
It's always a very complicated question for people who are supporting the sovereignty of any country. What kind of position they should take on what kind of tactics are appropriate or inappropriate. I think the bottom line for people who have been involved with the movement against Israeli apartheid, just as people who have been involved with the anti-war movement against the people of Iraq or Afghanistan or Vietnam or Korea, is to say that the main point and the overriding most important point is that also according to international law, that people who are living under occupation have the right to resist that occupation. And the occupation is the problem, not the resistance to it. So the solution to the problem of the Israeli occupation is to end that occupation and have a democracy that includes the indigenous inhabitants of the country, mm-hmm. the Palestinians. But I am not a member of or an uncritical supporter of any violent movement anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. I think when people were going around in the streets of the United States and saying "Ho ho Ho Chi Minh is going to win," they weren't saying that we think that everything that the Vietnamese Communist Party did or says represents us. In fact, lots of those people saying "Ho ho Ho Chi Minh" were anarchists and didn't even support the whole idea of communism in the first place. Mm-hmm. But what they did support is the idea of the sovereignty of the Vietnamese nation. Mm-hmm. And when certainly in the context of Israel-Palestine, what I and most of the rest of the left in outside of Germany on the entire planet support is the sovereignty of the Palestinian people. Mm-hmm. And so what kinds of tactics they use and whether they're communists or anarchists or Islamists or whether they are led by relatively corrupt politicians or not corrupt politicians is sort of beside the point. You know, the point is that they are under occupation and that the occupation is the problem.
But still, you can't really ignore the fact that some of these organizations still, you know, they do kill civilians, or even internally within their structures are quite authoritarian, be it towards women or homosexuals or so. Not all of it can be considered emancipatory.
So, no, certainly not. Mm-hmm. I completely agree. Mm-hmm. But, you know, certainly it's all relative. I mean, when you look at most of the main organizations in Palestine, you can see that they are in so many ways so much better than say the Saudi government, or you know, these other governments that are allies of the United States and Germany, and you know, so and in a way that's not particularly irrelevant whether they're better or worse than the Saudi government, but I think it is irrelevant point in that, you know, people are not going around you know, criticizing the U.S. or German relationship with Saudi Arabia, but maybe they should be, you know, because this is a government run by tyrants, but who are blatantly oppressing women and blatantly don't allow free speech, don't even have elections, whereas in Palestine they do have elections. Women are far better off in Palestine than they are in Saudi Arabia. I don't know. People, there's different factions in Palestine, and some are better than others. You know, people on the left would like to think that that they can support some kind of secular left institution, which they like to believe Fatah is. But I'd say that Fatah has terrible problems with corruption, whereas Hamas, which they is often painted as a terrible Islamist misogynist organization, is actually does a much better job than Fatah at taking care of the people, running cities, at providing people to the extent that they can with food and medicine, and you know, but there's lots to criticize about organizations in Palestine and around the world and governments around the world.
But how do you feel when you hear about casualties on the Israeli side? How does what go through your mind?
I think it's terrible when people are killed anywhere, and whether they're civilians or soldiers. I think it's just a terrible, tragic thing. And I wish it never happened. When people say, you know, supporters of Israel will often say that I don't write songs about the people killed by suicide bombers in Israel. That's not because I don't think I shouldn't. That I don't think I should write a song about that. I don't write songs about everything that I should write a song about. It's not like journalism. I'm just a songwriter, so I write songs when I have a good idea for a song. But I'm much more motivated to write songs about the suffering of the Palestinians because I live in the United States, where the media doesn't ever talk about, or almost never talks about, the suffering of the Palestinians. Or if they ever talk about it, it's just for a few seconds, and then most of the piece is going to be about how evil an Islamist Hamas is. My songwriting is happening in the context of the U.S. and in the context of living in the U.S., which is basically a big mind control experiment run by Fox News and Exxon, you know, and the U.S. military. you know, in that context, you know, Palestinian and Arab suffering generally is irrelevant to the mass media, and Jewish suffering and Israeli suffering is all that matters. And so I think that the suffering of the Jewish people is very well documented in the U.S. media, and every one of those people killed in Israel, every one of those Jews killed deserves to have their story told, and every one of them is a person, not just a number, and every one of them deserves all of that media attention they get. It's just that all the Palestinians also deserve the same kind of attention, and they don't get it. And so people like me, you know, we think that, you know, that we need to focus on the attention that the people who are not getting the attention.
Mm-hmm. Just going back on another song of yours, which is called The Death of Rachel Corrie. To summarize the story, Rachel Corrie was an activist doing solidarity work. She was involved with the International Solidarity Movement, and she was standing in front of a building in Palestine that was about to be destroyed by some caterpillar. And in that process of resisting, she was crushed and killed. Mm-hmm. And you were, as you wrote the song, you are describing it from the perspective of the driver of the caterpillar. And I was really moved by the line where you said, if you had met her in Jerusalem, this woman, Rachel, if you had met her in Jerusalem, you might have asked her on a date, but you were in Gaza. And so what were you thinking? Like, the person in the caterpillar, is that a different person from the person you would see on the street in Tel Aviv? Because you're on a mission in the caterpillar, but you're a civilian or so in the streets of Tel Aviv. What was your going through your mind
there? Yeah, I was thinking about how something that Rachel herself had written about how it's like all these children who are running the occupation and running the resistance. You know, she was at the time 23 years old, and she just was noticing how so many of the soldiers were like 18, 19 years old, and so many of the people opposing them, throwing rocks at the tanks, were 18, 17, 16, 15. You know, it's so much of the conflict is being conducted by children. Mm-hmm. And Or very young adults. Mm-hmm. And then of course, if they're in a different situation, they would be doing what teenagers do. You know, they'd be thinking about sex. You know, they'd be thinking about beer. You know, that what normal teenagers around the world do. That they think about, you know, hanging out in a club and, you know, drinking and trying to hook up. I mean, that's, you know, that's for better or for worse. That's normal life, and that's what they would be doing in the clubs in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, and that's what they're doing in Nablus too, maybe a bit less drinking and depending on the culture and what kind of behavior is appropriate. But they're all thinking about the same things, you know, that's what was. That's what was going through my head. If they met anywhere else in a different context, I mean, when I was in Palestine and getting into Nablus, first the Israeli soldier, helpfully sort of took me away from the Palestinian I was traveling with, just to make sure that I wasn't being kidnapped, apparently, and said, you know, are you safe? And is he kidnapping you or whatever? And I said, no, he's a friend of mine, and it's no problem. And he said, you know, you have to be careful in there. There's terrorists with bombs, and they're bad people. And I just, I thanked him for his concern, but I wanted to say, actually, if you ever tried going in there without your uniform on and without a machine gun hanging over your shoulder, you might find that they're really nice people who treat you very well and feed you the best food you've ever eaten, and you'd have a great time, which is what happens to most people who visit Palestine.
And do you believe in such a vision, or what would be your vision, you know, beyond the conflict, or what kind of solution you see for that area of the world, which many people, you know, just see no solution at all.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there. I don't know if it's possible for there to be any kind of solution without the United States stopping what it's doing, because, like in so many other situations around the world, there are big powers involved that have a lot of influence. Such as, say, the Syrian civil war. It's not necessarily up to the Syrians to decide what happens in Syria. Mm-hmm. And the Lebanese civil war 20 years ago, it wasn't up to the Lebanese to decide what happens in Lebanon. These are proxy wars fought by proxy armies, and that are all getting billions and billions of dollars from Iran and the United States and Saudi Arabia, Russia, and... they're small countries with proxy wars being fought by very large and very powerful countries. And as long as Israel has the military and diplomatic backing of the biggest power in the world today, I don't know if there's any hope for a solution. But I think if there is hope for a solution, or at some point when there might be hope for a solution, after we have socialism in the U.S., it's going to look like a multi-ethnic democracy. You're going to have to give Palestinians the vote.
You wrote a song called In One World, which we're going to listen to very soon. Could you give us a brief introduction? What is, you know, the aim of that song, or the context?
Yeah, it's often said, and it's true, that... that Israel is a country of refugees, and refugees, well, just like other settler countries, are actually countries of refugees. They like to say, at least in the propaganda in places like the U.S. and Canada and Australia, is people came here as immigrants seeking a better life and all this, and which is nonsense. People came there because they were escaping war and famine and oppression, and But and the same thing is true of Israel. It's refugees from Europe, and then of course people more ideologically driven people from the United States and Canada and places where they weren't suffering the way they were suffering in Europe. But also, anti-Semitism was a big problem back then in North America as well. Back when Israel formed, I think it's really not particularly an issue today in Europe or North America, but it certainly was then, and so the people who went to and colonized Palestine were refugees, and they created more refugees. They turned the Palestinians into refugees. And so the song In One World is actually based on a true story, based on a lot of true stories of back when it was easier for Palestinians to visit Israel. People who lived in the West Bank, Gaza, used to be able to go easily into Israel and work there, and they were the main source of cheap labor before the Russians came. And So it's a story about a Palestinian family coming from the West Bank and visiting the home that they were forcibly kicked out of in 1948, and meeting the Jewish Iraqi refugees who lived in the home that they used to live in, mm-hmm. and being invited in for coffee and having conversation. At the end of the song, I fantasize about... What it could have been like if the Iraqi refugees had said, "Well, why don't you just, add another floor on top of this house and let's all just live together," which is not actually what happened.
In 1948, I fled my village. The Stern gang drove my family from the lands. We ran into the desert, where I've spent these decades living by my hands. Life in Haifa wasn't easy, but so much better than this hellhole with the soldiers and barbed wire and the closures and the hunger, the humiliation and the checkpoints, the machine gun fire. And each day I wonder, after Haifa, the home that we abandoned when the Zionists had won, is there a family with a child? Does its father love it as I loved my only son before the soldiers shot him down, riddled him with bullets in his back and in his head? Home in Haifa, in my house, does his father know the pain there is in an empty bed? I fled my country, left the Tigris River for this foreign place. I had to leave home, I didn't want to, but they were rounding up the leftists and the papers had my face. And my son, a student leader on the streets of Baghdad, was nowhere to be found. So I walked through the mountains, just the shirt upon my back, knowing not where I was bound. Now here I am, this town of Haifa, in this little house, but at least I'm still alive. And each day I wonder, how is Baghdad? Would I recognize my friends if any did indeed survive? It took a long time, but I made a life here, and I wish my son could be here in this town upon the shore. I was with my wife, it was the Sabbath, when an old Arab couple knocked upon our door. We asked them in, gave them tea, that's what you do with strangers. We could see they meant no harm. We told our story, they told theirs. Us of our life in Baghdad, them of their family farm, and of this house which they once lived in, where once they raised a family long before their hair turned gray, and of their son and the troopers, and of ours, whom we still cry for every day. So much in common, so much gone bad, so much running and never coming home. You can hear the cars falling down, see the faces of the children forever forced to roam. And here we were in this house, fearing that tomorrow would be just like yesterday. So much resentment, so much at stake, and I really don't remember who was the first to say, in one world, in one village, in one home, let us live together. In one world, in one village, in one home, let us live together. In one world, in one village, in one home, let us live together. In one world.
Well, David, you're right now coming back from a tour in touring the world, basically. You've been now in Southeast Asia, in Japan, Hong Kong, and also touring Australia. Tell us a bit about the highlights of that tour, especially if we've heard you didn't manage to get into New Zealand. What happened?
Yeah, that was sort of like a non-highlight in a way, the tour of New Zealand that didn't happen, but I was about to board a flight from Tokyo to Auckland, and I got a call from somebody from Immigration New Zealand saying that I was not welcome in New Zealand, that she had been reading my blog, and she started quoting lots of stuff from my blog, and she said, you're not welcome to come to New Zealand. And
on what arguments? Like,
well, the argument was that I didn't have the proper visa lined up yet. Of course, legally, you can enter the country on a tourist visa and get your work visa once you're there. That's one way to do it, which I've done many times in Australia, but not in New Zealand. But I believe that's one thing I could theoretically have been allowed to do if they had wanted to allow me to do it. Or I could have gotten the work visa in Tokyo. But the way they have it set up in Tokyo is you have to send your passport to Shanghai for 2 weeks in order to get a work visa. So, they wouldn't let me come in, even though I'm from a country that's on the visa waiver program and doesn't need a visa to enter New Zealand, to enter as a tourist. You know, so they could theoretically have said, well, you can come in as a tourist, but you can't do these gigs until you get a work visa, which has happened to me before in Australia. And that's fine. Then I could have gotten a work visa or even canceled gigs if I had to. But in this case, they didn't let me into the country, and they read my blog in advance, and they called me in Tokyo, which is very unusual. This is the kind of thing that Israel does regularly with people trying to visit Israel. But this is not something that most countries do. Mm-hmm. And I talked to a lot of immigration lawyers and other people, frequent travelers and people who work for the airlines and from New Zealand, and they all said they had never encountered this, not once before.
But was this your first experience of being rejected at a border?
No, and I've been rejected from the Canadian border on numerous occasions, and I think it's basically because
you're in an international data.
Yeah, because I'm on a list that I think is supplied by the U.S. I think it's a list. But I don't know for sure, but I think it's probably provided by some U.S. intelligence agency, and it's probably distributed among all the countries they have a treaty with, which I believe at least includes Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and Great Britain.
And what did the Canadian authorities tell you then?
The first time I got turned away at the border, it was in 2002, before the G8 protests in Alberta, and this guy was not very experienced, young guy working in a very rural area where they don't get a whole lot of people crossing the border other than frequent travelers. And it was a place that straddles the Canadian and the U.S. sides of the Blackfoot Indian Reservation. So I think most of the people crossing the border are Blackfoot Indians who don't even need a passport to cross it. But this day they were checking everybody's passport and searching everybody's cars, even like old ladies and old elderly couples in traveling around in RVs and stuff. And so after searching my car, he was very confident that I was going to get through no problem, and he was a nice guy, and we were talking about music. And then the tune changed, and he was very, very shaken and physically shaking and looking very nervous. And he showed me a piece of paper that came out of his computer, which he, I'm sure, was not supposed to show me, that said David Rovics is a person of interest, and he's planning on crossing the border, and you should find a reason to turn him away. And it said, don't just turn him away for no reason, but find a reason to turn him away. Mm-hmm. And so he felt like he had to turn me away or he'd lose his job, and he said that. Mm-hmm. So that's when I knew I was on a list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we live in times of, you're publicly exposed, you write songs, you write blogs and so on, so the surveillance is kind of a tool to make life harder on people like you that express their political opinions.
Yeah.
What do you think about Israel? Do you think they will let you in next time you go to Israel?
I don't know. Last time I went in, I got in very easily because I was traveling with a young hippie from England, and we had a convincing story that we were hippies going in to see Israel and go to the Dead Sea and do what hippies do there. But when I was leaving Israel, I dropped off at the airport by people with Nazareth license plates, so Palestinians. And so that's a real no-no. They don't like that. And so They stopped us in the car twice, and then after my the people who were dropping me off left, then they questioned me for an hour and a half in the airport. And so I don't know if that now means I'm on a watch list and I'm going to have problems next time. I'm not sure. But I think that the reason why they were questioning me on the way out was because I was dropped off by Palestinians. I don't think it was because they knew what I was doing, because otherwise, well, maybe he would have mentioned something about that, you know. But I mean, I had been on the cover of a Palestinian newspaper, so you know, they could have seen that. But if he knew about that, he didn't say anything about it. So I don't know.
Okay, let's finish off with here now in Europe. I mean, you're touring Germany right now. This was not your first experience of having problems or frictions with the German left about your position and your critical position about the Israeli state. What do you hope for the future? What do you expect, or what would you hope for the coming gigs you will have in the future here around Germany or Europe?
Well, I mean, the German left is an active left, as you know, European countries go, and I expect to have lots more gigs in Germany in the future. But there is you know, certain elements, the anti-Deutsch elements that like to you know, try to press this issue of anti-Semitism, and which of course people in Germany are naturally very sensitive about. And so I'm sure I'll have more gigs in Germany in the future, and I imagine that I'll continue to have problems with the anti-Deutsch until, you know, until the German left more broadly is able to take a firmer position on this issue, which I think most, for the most part, they'd rather ignore. But the anti-Deutsch makes sure that they can't ignore it. So the anti-Deutsch tries to present the argument that you can either be, your options are to either be an anti-Semite and be critical of Israel, which according to them is the same thing, or support Israel and be a racist, which according to me is the same thing. Because Israel is a fundamentally racist state. It's founded on principles of racism. It's founded on apartheid, where Palestinians are systematically second-class citizens. So you cannot be an unconditional supporter of the government of Israel without being a racist. And so I think because the anti-Deutsch is forcing the issue, and perhaps because German history forces the issue and the existence of Israel forces the issue, for whatever reason, combination of reasons, ultimately the German left is going to have to you know, firmly decide where they stand on this issue. And certainly lots of people on the German left quite sensibly see that Israel is an apartheid state, and they're very uncomfortable with criticizing it, but they know that it is clearly an apartheid state, and that I'm right. But of course there are others who are, you know, feel less confident about taking that position and can be exploited by this very small minority of people who is, has their convoluted political perspective that sees me as an anti-Semite and even as a fascist, as I've been called on numerous occasions by anti-Deutsch.
At least I think when we organize gigs with David Rovix, it's even if you don't agree or you feel uncomfortable, for instance, with the criticism on the Israeli state, I don't see that is a reason for canceling a gig or saying, you know, this person is not allowed to play that gig, because I see you as a person that is dealing with many different issues. You know, going from environment, nuclear, or fracking, or squatting, or gender issues, historical stuff, and I think the stuff you sing and write about is very broad and general, and Palestine is one aspect of your work. Mm-hmm. And even if you don't agree 100% on your position, I don't think that's strong enough to not allow you to play somewhere. So I'm glad you were here in the studio, and you were able to expose or explain at least your visions on that. And I hope that people can get more clear picture about your thinking and your arguments. And we wish you the best of luck for all the tours and gigs that you will have in the future.
Thank you.
And I hope we will see you again in Freiburg whenever you get back to Europe.
I mean, I would just add that, you know, everybody has their dividing line issues, and I think there's something certainly to be said for saying, okay, this guy is an anti-Semite, and so we don't want to give him a platform. I don't want to give a platform to anti-Semites either. You know, I think the point is that I'm not an anti-Semite. You know, and also there may be something to be said for the idea of freedom of expression. And the left in around the world has lots of historical problems with the concept of freedom of expression. And maybe for good reason. You know, maybe some people shouldn't be allowed to say what they think. You know, I think that it becomes it's a very slippery slope and a big problematic issue when people are you know, have to go through real convolutions of logic to decide that someone's an anti-Semite. I mean, and then to not give them a platform. You know, I think people should err on the side of freedom of expression. That generally, unless you're absolutely certain that somebody is a real fascist. And you can tell who the fascists are. Golden Dawn, they're fascists. They beat up immigrants and they goose-step. That's fascism. You know, I'm not a fascist. You know, if you have to quote from 15 different songs and come up with a big essay and you still can't figure out if this guy's a fascist, then he's not a fascist. I'm not a fascist. You know, so... but, you know, there are important questions about freedom of expression and about whether or not to give somebody a platform. And I think... you know, people who are grappling with these questions are often very well-meaning, good people who are, for the most part, doing lots of good things, you know. But in this case, they're not.
I should be gigging in New Zealand now, but I'm not. I'm stuck at Narita instead. I should be singing in Dunedin, smoking kiwi pot and chilling with the Kiwi Reds. But when I showed up at the airport to board my flight, I was handed somebody's cell phone. Suddenly the future didn't look so bright, and I entered the twilight zone. The woman on the line said, "Hello, I'm from immigration. You may have a ticket, but you can't go to our great island nation." I felt like I'd been hit in the face with a big old Kiwi lock. But then I felt the Stasi's cold embrace when she said, "I've been reading your blog. The spies are reading my blog, the introduction and the prologue. And if that's so, it just might be true that they're watching this video too." Well, I normally don't get many views, a few hundred friends and kooks. So it comes as surprising news that some of them are Kiwi spooks. I try to get my missives out and cause some small commotion. Someone's listening now, there's no doubt, across the South Pacific Ocean. The spies are reading my blog, the introduction and the prologue. And if that's so, it just might be true that they're watching this video too. "Were you strip searched in Trondheim?" she asked. "What kind of things do you smoke? Have you ever been charged with a crime? Are you rich or are you broke? Have you ever been turned away from any borders you tried to cross? What kind of venues did you plan to play? Do you use dental floss?" I said, "It seems a bit unusual for you to do things quite this way." I asked her, "Is this normal?" But she wouldn't say. She just repeated her message, "At Narita you shall remain. I've read your blog, each vile passage, and you may not board that plane." The spies are reading my blog, the introduction and the prologue. And if that's so, it just might be true that they're watching this video too. there watching this video too. Watching this video too.